Cobb, and Cobb seems to have sort of, he asserts his rights and he has police protection. I mean, how does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. Just in the past few months, the FBI has put out reports about the domestic terror threat. And, you know, when you talk about domestic terrorism, because, of course, all of the focus on so-called terrorism in the United States is always about so-called Islamist terrorism. And mm-hmm. actually, these people are a much bigger threat to U.S. society. You know, but in the FBI report, they're actually putting on par so-called black identity extremists, as they call it. So, in other words, the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-racist activists, they're putting them on par with these white supremacists, which is exactly what Trump did when he said, well, what about the so-called alt-left, you know, in response to the alt-right? It's like, as if, you know, these very terrifying racists who walk around with these huge rifles, I think the term sexy rifles is used in the film, is somehow, you know, equivalent with people pushing back against that and struggling for equality. It's ridiculous. But
there's no comparison. The right-wingers are threatening violence. They're going in proposing violence.
Right. And
verbally. They're saying we're coming in to, you know, blood's going to run down the streets. I mean, that's what they say.
And could you imagine?
Sorry to pause you there. We're just going to move on. We'll continue the discussion.
It began with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Southern Poverty Law Center has stalked me for about 7 years. This is literally the fourth time via which they or their operatives have done this to me. That is, stalked me, gotten me fired, gotten me evicted, gotten me run out of countries even. I'm not young. You know, I'm an older guy. So why don't they say, just leave this cantankerous kind of a odd fellow alone? No, they're not going to do that, you see. For some reason, they simply will not allow the infinitesimal few of us that there are to keep one another's company freely and openly.
In the early 2000s, the federal government was cracking down on white supremacists, and there was a high-level U.S. Attorney Task Force that was created to deal with that threat. The last time they were supposed to meet was actually on 9/11. The federal government turned on a dime very quickly for obvious reasons and focused almost all of its attention on Islamic extremism. Therefore, the government was left with no intelligence agencies fighting back against the kinds of groups that the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks. That's pretty serious. You know, there's a few hundred thousand of these people in the United States. Some of them, in the vein of Cobb, are willing to use weapons in ways that are dangerous. Some of them are willing to kill.
So there was little Cobb with his haircut and almost unrecognizable. And I want to talk about the wider issues now in the film. I think this part of the documentary was one of the most eye-opening parts. We see that after the advent of 9/11, that there was more of a crackdown on Muslims than white supremacists. Marcel, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been the dominant theme of counterterrorism in the United States since 9/11, definitely. And, you know, I think it's just come to the surface again in the past maybe year or 2 years that, well, there's actually, you know, vast number of white supremacists who are willing to, as she said, there kill. And, you know, like, you can see Cobb walking around in the streets with these huge rifles. I mean, could you imagine for a second this being two African Americans and the police having the same sort of response to them? You know, basically, like, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, you're just going to go home. All right, fine, sir, please go on your way. And then they get arrested afterwards, of course. But, you know, we know very well that if this was an African American, you know, pair walking in the streets, that they would probably be gunned down by those same police officers, right? So, you know, you can see the relationship between Cobb and the white nationalists and the police forces and the authorities and powers that be as well. And I think that's such an important part of this documentary.
And Rich, if I could turn to you, we saw actually in the film that Kylan Dutton, one of Cobb's supporters in the film, he says that white children under the age of 5 are now the minority in the U.S. for the first time, and he's concerned about this. And do you think that they go to leave as a sort of sense of sanctuary, that they're under attack and they're being victimized?
Yeah, I don't think that statistic is true. In fact, I'm sure it's not. But yeah, they're going there thinking, oh, we're under attack. You know, us white people are, you know, we're the persecuted. That's never been true, obviously, and it's not been true in history. And I don't know why they feel like they're under attack. I think I don't know. I can't.
Do you think it would have been good to explore that a bit more?
You listen to them talk, and you think it's very rare that I hear someone talk, and I can't put my mind. You know, I can't see the situation through their eyes. And this guy Kynan was, and his wife is in the film as well. They talk. They're quite reasonable. They're quite articulate. But I can't identify with anything they say. I can't sit there and say, oh, I see your point, because their point is just, it's just warped, it's wrong, and I don't know if they're, obviously they're just living in their circle of friends, and they have news that they're believing, and they're not really paying attention to what's actually happening in the world.
It raises many questions, yes, and we get little glimpses into their lives.
And I think it's interesting in the film that, it basically is a First Amendment issue, and America is unusual that hate speech is not illegal in America. It's protected. So people can say the most horrifying things. They can fly their swastikas, which you can't do in Europe. You can't say those things in Europe. But you can say them there. And it's a different legal situation. So that's why you watch it, and it's for a European especially, it's really horrifying to see. Because you couldn't do that in Europe.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there on that note, and please do watch this documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. And don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Djawadi Amuli. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to continue, and I'm back now again, and I do wish to try to finish off sharing some important points that is valuable for all of us to learn about here in this book. We were talking about some of the common courtesies, some of the etiquettes, hygienic, public, things that we need to observe, not only for ourselves on a personal level, but also things that we need to observe as far as us representing ourselves in front of others. Well, on the topic of mental health, and we did say that mental health is divided into two parts, al-aql, intellect, and al-qalb, the heart. Let me read the hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And he's talking about having a healthy body. And then he says, وَأَفْضَلُ مِنْ صَحَّةِ الْبَدَنِ تَقْوَى الْقَلْبِ. And better than having a healthy body is having a pious heart. Another hadith. La waja'a awja'u lilqalbi min al-dhunub. There's nothing that will hurt the heart more than sin. Another hadith, Ala wa inna min sahhati al-badan taqwal qalb. One of the important elements of having a healthy body is the piety of the heart, taqwa al-qalb, that your heart is wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Another hadith, فَإِنَّ تَقْوَى اللَّهِ شِفَاءُ مَرَضِي أَجِسَّامِكُمْ. This is in Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says that one of the means of taqwa Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in it resulting in curing sicknesses of your body. Now, there are many effects that a healthy heart produces, and when we're talking about here, when we're talking about a healthy heart, we're talking about the spiritual side of a healthy heart. And in the verses of the Holy Quran, and also in the ahadith and riwayat of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they kind of bring both of them together, and an example for this. Let me read to you what it says as far as, you know, that heart is concerned. You know that in the Holy Quran, the word qasat qulubuhum has been used frequently. So this qaswatul qalb or qasawatul qalb, having a hard heart, you know, in Farsi they say sang dil, which means having a heart of stone, pretty much means that there's that fragility of the heart, that sympathizing kind of heart that is vibrant with remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in it being activated through, you know, spiritual awareness and connection and feelings, positive feelings. All of that is eliminated and disappears when a person has a darkened heart, has a black heart.
Ayatollah Javadi Omri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in the Islamic world.
And the main factor that leads to a hardened heart is, of course, without doubt, as we know, sin. Now, that's why in the Quran it's referred to in different ways. The heart in the negative side is referred to as being hardened, as having been qaswa, having being hardened, as blinded, as being a blind heart, and also as being rusted, dirty. Kalla bal rana ala qulubihim. You know, that rain is, of course, something that has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. Now, what are the things that lead to having a hardened heart? Just before I mention that, I'd like to mention a very interesting hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam that's also mentioned here, where he says, "La ilm katalab al-salama." There is no knowledge better than seeking health. You know, these are for those people who are very much into health. That's a very, very interesting area in Islam. La ilm katalab al-salama. There is no knowledge better than seeking health. Or there's no knowledge equal to that of seeking health. Wala salama, and there is no health better or equal than salamatul qalb, than having a healthy heart. And that's all to do with, you know, al-qalbu salim, a pure heart. It's all to do with avoiding going down that path of a dark, black heart. يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهَ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ. الْقَلْبُ السَّلِيمُ is ultimately the objective and the goal that we want to have. And that's why, you know, one of the things that we need to always remember, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he said, "Ya Abu Dhar," he said to Abu Dhar, "O Abu Dhar, Inna Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala, Almighty God, La yanzuru ila suwarikum, God doesn't look at the way you look, your images, your form. Wala ila amwalikum, and He doesn't look at your wealth, He doesn't look at your money. But God, walakin yanzuru ila qulubikum wa a'malikum, but God will look at your hearts and at your deeds." Inshallah, we will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
فدعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by our Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum as-salam, Brother Mahdi, and as-salamu alaykum to all the dear brothers and sisters who are listening to this program. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all mine, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. In this series, at first, we all are going to listen to a recitation of the Noble Quran recited by a famous reciter. After it, Brother Muhammad will analyze that recitation, and at the end, we are going to listen to a short speech about the Noble Quran. Stay tuned, dear audience. We'll be right back. Dear audience, today in the first part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, we're going to listen to an Iraqi reciter who recited in the Islamic Republic of Iran, Sheikh Maitham al-Tammar. He recited Surah An-Nahl, verses 124 to 128, in the presence of Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Dear audience, let's listen to it preceded by its English translation.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful. The Sabbath was only prescribed for those who differed concerning it. And verily, your Lord will judge between them on the day of resurrection about that wherein they used to differ. Invite to the way of your Lord with wisdom and fair preaching, and argue with them in a way that is better. Truly, your Lord knows best who has gone astray from his path, and he is the best aware of those who are guided. And if you punish your enemy, then punish them with the like of that with which you were afflicted. But if you endure patiently, verily it is better for the patient. And endure patiently, O Muhammad, your patience is only from Allah. And grieve not over them, and be not distressed because of what they plot. Truly Allah is with those who fear Him, and those who are good doers.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إنما جعل السبت على الذين اختلفوا فيه وإن ربك ليحكم بينهم يوم القيامة فيما كانوا فيه يختلفون ادع إلى سبيل ربك بالحكمة والموعظة الحسنة وجادلهم بالحسنة
التي هي أحسن وجادلهم بالتي هي أحسن إن ربك هو أعلم بمن ضل عن سبيله وهو أعلم بالمهتدين وإن عاقبتم فعاقبوا بمثل ما عوقبتم به ولئن صبرتم لهو والذين هم محسنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Dear audience, you just listened to the Iraqi reciter Sheikh Maitham Tamar reciting verses 124 to 128 of Surah An-Nahl. Now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, Sheikh Maitham al-Tammar, he recited verses 124 to 128 of Surah An-Nahl, and he has a very good voice and a very good tone and melody. And especially in the first verse that he recited, he recited in Maqam Hijaz, and then he changed it to Maqam Sika. Okay, now let's analyze this recitation in terms of Tajweed.
Good idea.
In verse
124.
In verse 124, إنما جعل السبت. We have a scene with Shadda, and scene is a letter of Rakhawa.
It's a weak
frequency. So the timing is longer than the other groups of letters, which are plosives, the letters of Shadda, and also the letters of Tawassut,
which are fricatives.
Yeah, the fricatives that are not too weak.
Lin Umar.
And of course, Mim and Nun, they're not fricatives, they're nasal stops.
Yes.
Only Ayn and. Yeah, only Ayn is a fricative.
Lam
is not a fricative.
Lam
is something else.
Liquid,
yes. Lin, Nun is nasal stop. Ayn is a letter of Tawassul, the fricative.
This is fricative.
Mim is a
nasal stop.
Again, a nasal stop. And Ra is a
glide,
similar to a fricative. Ra. It's more like a trill. No, but you should not trill the Ra. Anyway, so we have a sabit. إِنَّمَا جُعِلَ السَّبْتِ. The scene is held for some time. Of course, not too much, so that it would be as long as two vowel counts. No, it should be less than that. The ba in the word سَبْتِ has the sukun. As a result, you have to apply قَلْقَلَ. إِنَّمَا جُعِلَ السَّبْتُ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اخْتَلَفُوا فِيهِ. The خَا is ساكن. It's also a letter of رَخَاوَة. And the timing should be just like the scene. عَلَى الَّذِينَ اخْتَلَفُوا فِيهِ. Hold the خَا a little bit.
And the alif is not pronounced.
Exactly. The alif of wasl or the hamzat of wasl is not pronounced. عَلَى الَّذِينَ اخْتَلَفُوا. The خَا has تَفْخِيم at the second lowest level because of the sukun.
Yes.
وَإِنَّ رَبَّكَ لَيَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ قِيَامَةِ. The qaf has a kasra. As a result, we have the lowest level of tafkhim.
How to apply it?
قِيَامَةِ. You pronounce the qaf with a kasra by preserving the sound of kasra. If you say قِيَامَةِ, قِيَامَةِ doesn't sound like a kasra. Mm-hmm. E. We need the E sound. قِيَامَةِ.
So we should drop the lips.
Well, sometimes that helps, but not necessarily. If you say قِيَامَةِ, قِيَامَةِ without dropping the lips, yeah, it's also possible.
But
spreading
it helps
the lips, you mean?
Yeah,
it helps. It could help. فِيمَا كَانْ, the same shape as you pronounce kasra, e.
Yeah.
E.
Yeah.
Okay. فِيمَا كَانُوا فِيهِ يَخْتَلِفُونَ. And the next verse, udaru. We have a hamzatul wasl at the beginning of this word. And how do we know that it's pronounced with a dhamma and not a fatha or kasra?
Because actually the first mutaharrik letter has a dhamma.
Yes. Udu'u ila sabili rabbika. The ra has tafkhim because of the fatha. It should be pronounced with velarization. Rabbika bil hikmati wal maw'izati al hasana. In the word al maw'izah, we have matulin, a waw sakina preceded by a meme with a fatha. Aw. Aw, we have
it's
the aw sound,
actually.
It's a diphthong. Wal maw'izati al hasana. The waw in the word maw'izah has tafkhim because it's a letter of isti'la, and all letters of isti'la have to be pronounced with tafkhim.
Oh, with the thickness, actually. Thank you, dear brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. And now the third part of the program, let's recite the Quran. We all are going to listen to a short speech by Dr. Shomali talking about the Noble Quran. Let's enjoy it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We continue our daily short talks on the Quran. My request is everyone should think, what can I do so that I make my children and family more familiar with the Quran? There is always a way to improve. I don't think anyone can say, I have reached end of it. There is always a way to improve your family's familiarity and acquaintance with the Quran. Second, what can I do to help people in the community? Maybe my family are, alhamdulillah, very well learned about the Quran. They are themselves teachers of the Quran. But what can I do to improve the level of familiarity with the Quran in the community? Maybe I can help by volunteering my time, my knowledge, my skills, my money to improve the overall level of engagement with the Quran in our community. And thirdly, what can I do to share with humanity beautiful teachings of the Quran? May inshallah Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala include you among the people who are most appreciative of this great blessing of Quran.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, what you just listened to was a short speech by Dr. Shomali. And that was the final part of the program. Let's recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Click on the tab Call of Islam on the top right of the page, and there you can have access to all our programs as well as the other programs of the radio. Until our next episode, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye.
سبحان سبحان يا خالق الإنسان نورنا بالقرآن بمصحف الإيمان ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين ندعوك نرجوك يا مالك التكوين املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن املأ قلبي قرآن اشرح صدري قرآن
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, you're with me, your host Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. Now we kick things off with a developing story. As the United Nations says, it will raise the detention of Princess Latifah, the daughter of Dubai's ruler, with the United Arab Emirates. A UN investigation into the alleged abduction and incarceration of the princess could follow. This comes after a new video of her surfaced in which she describes her conditions. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom has waded into the debate but stopped short of exerting pressure on its Middle Eastern ally, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
Sheikha Latifah bint Mohammed Al Maktoum, the missing daughter of Dubai's billionaire ruler, made international news in 2018 when she posted a video of herself just before she tried to flee Dubai.
All my father cares about is his reputation. He will kill people to protect his own reputation. He only cares about himself and his ego. So this video could save my life. And if you are watching this video, it's not such a good thing.
In a new video published by the BBC, Latifah says on the last leg of her escape to India, her boat was intercepted and she was beaten, injected with a tranquilizer and dragged back to Dubai, where she was imprisoned in a villa.
I'm a hostage and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement. No access to medical help.
Seconding Latifah's story is Princess Haya, the youngest of the Sheikh's six wives. In March 2020, the UK's High Court found Sheikh Maktoum guilty of waging a campaign of fear and intimidation against her and abducting two of his adult daughters. Princess Latifah, and before her, Princess Shamsa, who was snatched off the streets of Cambridge, England. It said Tony Blair's Labour government dropped a criminal inquiry into Shamsa's abduction as a diplomatic favour to the Sheikh. And it seems those favours keep coming. The UK is reluctant to condemn the billionaire.
A very difficult case, and I think it is concerning. We always raise human rights issues with all of our partners, including the UAE. There's no particular British locus in this case, but we are concerned by this.
Described as the Queen's close friend, the Sheikh has hundreds of millions of pounds worth of property in the UK and billions in investments.
We want politicians and former politicians and world leaders and, you know, celebrities and so-called influencers, all these people that go to Dubai and the UAE and promote that country, to wake up and see what the reality is. This is a country that is literally, I mean, people will be on those beaches in Dubai a few hundred metres away from where Latifah is essentially in solitary confinement, a hostage.
Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum has denied all the charges against him, saying his daughter Latifah was kidnapped for ransom in 2018 and she was returned to Dubai after a successful rescue operation. He insists she is now safe and in perfect health. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Author and journalist Yvonne Ridley is with us from the Scottish border. Yvonne, great to see you. Now, do you think that international pressure will force Dubai's Sheikh here to perhaps release his daughter or at least provide more transparency?
Yes, it will take international pressure, but the UAE is sensitive to, you know, when enough pressure is applied. We've seen this before in other cases. You know, the recent fallout and siege between Qatar, the UAE, Saudi, that crumbled and fell away when enough pressure was applied to Saudi, the UAE, and its allies. And now they're trying to normalize relations with Qatar. So when enough international pressure is applied, I think that the West has grown weary of these petulant Arab royals. And I think that the tide is turning, you know, with the new administration in the White House. And whatever happens in Washington, I'm sure that Boris Johnson will follow.
Now, why is the UK reluctant to be a little bit more strident over these allegations? Because if what she's saying is true, it speaks to something a little bit darker at the heart of what's going on in the UAE.
Absolutely. Well, the stumbling block are the eye-watering amounts involved in the arms deals with the UAE. And also the UAE is a huge investor in Britain, and so the UK will be reluctant to rock the boat. But I do think it's time to call a halt, to say, on these petulant royals who think, you know, that they can, that they're above the law. They certainly might be in the UAE, but they're not in the UK. And last year we heard that a judge said that one of the other daughters, Shamsa, was abducted in August 2000 from the streets of Cambridge. This is a kidnapping on British soil. It's outrageous that nothing has been done about it. Of course, Tony Blair was Prime Minister at the time. This is a great opportunity for Boris Johnson to stand up and say that this is an untenable situation. And, you know, there should be an investigation at the very least. Kidnapping is a crime. It's not a, you know, it's a crime in Britain as well as an international crime. And somebody should be held to account. But we need to apply pressure through news programs like this, through international friendships, through the United Nations, in any possible way that we can. And I'm sure a lot of holidaymakers who have flocked to Dubai
indeed
might think again.
Yvonne Ridley, great to see you, and thank you so much for your time, as always. Now to some other news now, because French lawmakers on Tuesday overwhelmingly voted in favor of the controversial new separatism bill. Emmanuel Macron's centrist government has argued that the new bill will aim to reduce so-called Islamic separatism by strengthening the oversight of mosques, schools and sports clubs. Macron has controversially stated in the past that, quote, Islam is a religion which is experiencing a crisis today all over the world. Critics of that bill have stated that the now passed legislation discriminates against France's strong 5.7 million Muslim community. Known as Article 18, the bill passed with 347 to 151 with 65 abstentions in the lower houses and is now set to be examined by senators on the 30th of March.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
And Richard Sudan, it seems another day will not go by without some more disturbing news coming across the pond to us. This time it seems white supremacy goes all the way to the top and a very, very well-known black organization is not going to stand for it.
fascinating first story to begin with, Amina. So just days after Donald Trump was actually acquitted in impeachment proceedings against him, in which he was accused of inciting the January 6 riots in Washington, D.C., the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, are suing Trump under the Anti-Ku Klux Klan Act for basically the same charges, intimidation and inciting the Capitol riot. Now, a bit of background is the Ku Klux Klan Act actually came into being in 1871 to prevent white supremacist groups from interfering with the daily politics of Congress, and now that act is being evoked in a lawsuit being brought against Donald Trump, his now former lawyer Rudy Giuliani, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And regardless of how this pans out, it's another scathing indictment of those names and groups, and of course Donald Trump himself. For those who don't know, what's actually interesting is that this isn't the first time that the Trump name has been associated or linked with the Ku Klux Klan. In 1927, Donald Trump's father was actually arrested following a pro-Ku Klux Klan Italian fascist demonstration in Jamaica, Queens.
Oh dear, going all the way back there, Richard. But let's stick it to the present, where we have some rather colourful social media reactions.
Certainly are. Let's go to Liz C., who says the fact that Republican Representative Bennie Thompson, with the backing of the NAACP, filed a lawsuit against Trump and Giuliani, citing the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 for January the 6th, is the epitome of sweet and swift karma. And Curtis chimes in with, people in America, I bet you Trump didn't even know that a law like the Ku Klux Klan law existed in the civil rights laws. If he is found guilty of breaking these laws, he won't be able to pay his way out of this one. And actually, I suspect, Amina, this won't be the first lawsuit that Donald Trump is facing since he's vacated the White House.
And from the right in the United States to the right this side of the Atlantic, what have you got for us?
Indeed, and a friend of Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, calls for scrapping of EU Human Rights Act on Twitter, but one problem, it doesn't exist. So basically there was a bizarre rant, really. Nigel Farage took to Twitter to make some observations, I think, about Heathrow Airport, and he kind of was bashing asylum seekers, calling them criminals and doing the usual kind of stuff that Nigel Farage does. But he's being ridiculed and mocked because Farage cited the EU Human Rights Act as needing to be scrapped. But the problem is it doesn't actually exist. And, you know, this is really reflective of not just Nigel Farage and the liars and the untruths that we heard in the Brexit campaign, but really the liars and the untruths about, you know, immigration that were really whipped up and led millions to voting for Brexit, which many people really see would almost be an endorsement of Nigel Farage's views. And it's interesting, the kind of bizarre tirade on Twitter really reminded me of the stuff we came used to hearing from Donald Trump in the sort of latter stage of his presidency. Just a really weird tirade of kind of falsehoods and loaded assertions, Amina. And Farage is being mocked mercilessly online because of it.
Tweets?
So let's go first to Jack Bailey, who says, quite interestingly, it's quite amazing that in my 3 years of studying law, I haven't come across the EU Human Rights Act. And we have one from Femi, sorry, who says, Farage knows the Human Rights Act is a piece of UK law which mirrors the Council of Europe's. But he basically figured my followers hate the EU, so if I call it the EU Human Rights Act, they'll be too rabid and frothy to realise I'm actually manipulating them.
And one might wonder here, Richard, Brexit's happened. You've got your wish, Nigel. Why are you still here?
Well, it's almost like Amina, he just wants the limelight, and it's almost like he'll say anything to play to his base and to remain in the limelight for as long as possible. Because let's not remember, Farage was never elected to Parliament. He spent his entire career bashing the European Union, where he actually took a pretty handsome salary his entire career there. So a lot of people really view Farage as a kind of populist demagogue. Of course, that's not what I'm saying, Amina.
Not at all, Richard. None of us are saying that. All right, we leave it right there. We move now to the Netherlands, where a Dutch court has ordered the country's government to end an overnight curfew, which aims to curb the spread of the coronavirus, adding that it breaches the right to free movement. The court said the 9 p.m. to 4:30 a.m. curfew, which was imposed by the government last month, was done so by an emergency law when there was no acute emergency. In a tit-for-tat move by the country's lawmakers, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte urged the public to continue staying at home despite the court ruling, as the curfew is a means, not an end. So far, the Netherlands has recorded over 1 million coronavirus cases and nearly 15,000 deaths. Now, the separatist movement in Spain's northeastern region of Catalonia has increased its power after securing nearly 51% in the regional elections held over the weekend. The three main parties who want to create an independent Catalan state expanded their majority in the regional parliament to 74 seats from a possible 135. Now, Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez's party won the most votes, but the growing influence of the separatist movement will mean more of a pressure for a future independence referendum. Spanish nationalist far-right party Vox won 11 seats ahead of the People's Party, Spain's main conservative group, and Vox is already the third largest party in Spain's national parliament. Well, Kasai Kedri joins us from Barcelona. And Kasai, good to see you. What do these results mean for the future of Spain and Catalonia's relationship?
Alina, the relationship between the central government in Madrid and the regional government in Catalonia is likely to remain tense, at least until the term of the next parliament expires in the coming 4 years, if it is not upended by Spain or by Spanish judiciary for any breach or other reason. And the reason behind that is that the central government of Madrid, a socialist, had an original plan prior to the election. It meant to break the decade-long grip of the separatists on the regional parliament by sending their strong man, the popular Minister of Health, a Catalan, to Catalonia to lead their list. The idea was that Salvador Illa, the socialist, strikes some kind of coalition government with the more moderate part of the pro-independence movement represented by ERC, Esquerra Republicana, the Republican Left Party led by jailed leader Oriol Junqueras. Obviously, that plan failed because on the eve of the election, the pro-independence parties were forced to sign a manifesto in which they pledged not to seek any alliance with the socialists. Right after that happened, as you mentioned, the socialists came on top of the game, but the problem is they cannot form a government. So again, the separatists are now sort of trying to seek a new alliance. But will they be able to form a government? That really remains to be seen. Because if they do succeed, it would be on what ground? Will they outgrow their differences, which are really huge? The three parties that you mentioned, the pro-independence three parties, do not agree on many, many levels. They are on ideological different lines, on economic different lines, and they also disagree on the policy to be adopted vis-a-vis Madrid.
Very briefly, Kasai, we do know that there have been independence leaders jailed and so on. At what cost are they willing to continue to push for independence here?
They can't really afford to do that, because even if they won a majority of votes, that victory has to be nuanced, because between 2017 and 2021, the separatists have lost almost over 600,000 votes, and that is mainly due to the high abstention rate between the two elections. Also, you need to take into account that the nature of Catalan society is evolving vis-a-vis the independence project. It is not as unilateralist as it used to be in the past. Now, some in this electorate, in the pro-independence electorate, is seeking a more nuanced independence, probably within a more federalist understanding of what a future Catalonia means. Probably a Catalonia within Spain, but with more economic freedom.
Indeed, Kasai, always a pleasure. Thank you. And now we keep things in Barcelona, because violent protests erupted overnight after police arrested the rap artist Pablo Hasél for allegedly insulting the monarchy and glorifying terrorism. Thousands of protesters marched towards Spain's regional government delegation, while some demonstrators set alight garbage cans and threw rocks at police. Several stores and a bank were damaged, and at least three people were detained and four police officers injured, according to regional police. Asel's case has been linked to the government's sudden announcement that it will change a national law that some say curtails the freedom of expression. Hi, good to have you back. And we're going to kick things off with Ahmed Caballo and his take and the social media reaction to what's been going on in Myanmar, Ahmed.
Yes, so many international observers are describing what's happened in Myanmar as a coup, as a military trying to take power after the elections at the beginning of February, where the National League for Democracy received over 59% of the vote and the military's party did extremely poor. Now, they've initially charged her with possessing illegal walkie-talkies, and now they've said that she's violated the country's national disaster law because she violated the COVID rules. Now, many think these are trumped-up charges and a way for the military to grab power from the popular leader. But there is a bit of a mixed reaction online, because while she is very popular in Myanmar, and I can attest to that myself as I lived in the country for 3 months, internationally, many people think of her very differently because of the way that she's handled the Rohingya crisis and the way that she's essentially belittled the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya people in the Rakhine state. Now, we've seen some of that mixed reaction online. The first tweet, very much supportive, Bunny says, after the military announced how people of Myanmar are with them in yesterday's press conference, broadcast by their own unreliable and fake news media, this is the crowd protesting against the military today. And as you can see, it's huge crowds. But Shada says, Western media, once again, mostly focus on the arrest of Aung San Suu Kyi, less on the fate of Myanmar. She should be released, but not absolved of her disregard for the plight of the Rohingya and being the army's BFF for years. And a final tweet by Horror Unfolding says, it's the Anglos who are fanning the chaos in Myanmar. Democracy and human rights, they were so quiet when their darling Aung San Suu Kyi condoned the massacre of the Muslim Rohingya minority by the military and the monks. Once more, she's the flagship of Western democracy. Poop.
Indeed, the very well-known technical term. And we move from one coup in the making, well, to another in Latin America. Explain.
US Organization for American States, Colombia, trying to steal Ecuador's election on popular socialist candidate while spreading fake news. It's an article from The Grey Zone written by my good friend Ben Norton, and it's describing precisely what's happened in Ecuador, where the socialist Andres Arauz got 32.71% of the vote in the first round, which was a massive majority, with second and third place getting 19.7 and 19.3 respectively. However, he did fall short of the 40% margin needed to win the first round outright. But what's happened since then is the other candidates, particularly Yaku Perez, which is the US-backed environmentalist candidate. Now, the Colombian prosecutors have also got involved and accused Andres Arauz for having links to the socialist guerrilla movement, the National Liberation Army, the ELN, and it has even posted links of this online, which is men dressed up in ELN uniforms, but actually many observers have said that these are actually Ecuadorians putting on a dodgy Colombian accent. And you can see the plot, because the same thing happened in Bolivia in 2019, where the Organization for the American States, which has 70% of its funding from the United States, is again instrumental in trying to overthrow a popular leader because they do not want to see the return of the pink tide in Latin America. Now, I got a tweet from Evo Morales, who was a former Bolivian president. He says, we alert on the plan of the right and the US in Ecuador to try and prevent Arauz's triumph in the second round, using Colombian prosecutor, parties from the right and the OAS. We have an obligation to defend democracy and our regional integration. And Code Pink says, after a brief hiatus during which the US experienced a coup attempt of its own, not so fun, US imperialists are back to their ongoing attempts to sabotage democracy and incite US-backed OAS-supporting coups in Latin America. Hashtag Ecuador.
Wow, it seems if at first you don't succeed, nip across the border and try again. We'll, of course, continue to watch that one very closely. And I must point out that some of the methods that were being used by the other opposition parties here are bordering on the illegal. Thank you so much, Ahmed Caballo. And that is it for us for tonight. Thanks for being with us. Stay safe.